Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Cadwell Turnbull, author of the novel We Are the Crisis, which has received star reviews from Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Review. It is his sequel to the award-winning 2021 novel, No Gods, No Monsters. His debut novel, The Lesson, won the Newcomb Institute Literary Arts Award. And welcome back to the show, Cadwell.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Cadwell, one of the things I do want to say is I'm glad to see that you haven't really started graying because of the incredible amount of characters you have in this novel and all the different plot lines and themes. I was hoping that this wouldn't affect your appearance.
Well, my hair is very low right now. If it was a little bit bigger, you'd see all the gray. There's quite a bit of gray.
So to get started, I wanted you to give a summary of No Gods, No Monsters for those who haven't read it so they can sort of have an understanding of where we're going with We Are the Crisis.
Yeah, so, you know, No Gods, No Monsters, I talk about it as being like a mashup between, or the inspirations are The Wire and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Those are like the comp titles. So the community as character of The Wire and the politics of The Wire, like a mosaic cast, lots of intersecting narratives, and the fantasy elements of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. No Gods, No Monsters, you know, it follows several characters as they learn, some of them human, some of them not, that monsters have existed along humans for a really long time. This is just coming out into the world, and it follows how the world responds to that change. And then We Are the Crisis picks up a few years after, showing the world has somewhat adjusted to that new information, but there has been quite a bit of blowback from that revelation.
So one of the events that sort of really drive the narrative and goes over into the second book is what is referred to as the Boston Massacre.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so right. Share what you would like to share about the Boston Massacre.
So, you know, one of the things that starts happening in the first book is isolated hate crimes. So people that are suspected of being monsters are attacked, brutalized, sometimes they are killed. And so these things start happening, and it kind of brings into being like a monster solidarity movement. So like people supporting monsters or monster sympathetic individuals. And during the climax of the first book, there's this kind of like mass demonstration. There's like a collective march that happens in Boston. And, you know, how can I talk about this without spoiling? Well, the march ends up being broken up because of mass shooters, basically. And that event causes some ripple effects that affect the second book.
Well, I can't help but read your novels, your two in this series. This We Are the Monsters. We Are the Crisis is the second of planned three novels. And see, it's sort of a metaphor on a lot of things that have happened in the past, civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. And today, when you started writing this novel, did you realize that you'll be writing a novel that could be interpreted based on some of the clashes and conflicts of the day, that would be it?
Yeah, I mean, I pitched the novel to the publisher as being like a civil rights era, like, movement set in the present, but with monsters instead of black and brown people. It is also about, you know, intersectionality. So a lot of the people that are monsters are from marginalized backgrounds. But that was how I initially pitched it. I was like, think civil rights movement, but with monsters as the people that are advocating for their human rights. As
I
I've
gotta
been
stop
working
you real
on it.
quick. I want you to, so that term intersectionality is not a term that's maybe out there in the general public. It's maybe
Okay.
within a niche of sort of that combination of I'm both black and a woman. Could you sort of give your interpretation of that and why it's so important to look at? It's almost like having more than one barrier to, not almost, more than one barrier to overcome. Trans,
Yeah.
black, et cetera.
Right. And I think, you can think about it in terms of marginalization. And sure, the books do that, but I think you can also think about it from the as like a general human characteristic that you have various within yourself, various identities intersecting. And some of them are privileged identities and some of them are not. And then some of them in combination with each other leads to certain amounts of privilege or marginalization. So like there's a character in the book, Ridley, who is trans, who is a like leftist anarchist individual, but he's also upper middle class. He's mixed race and upper middle class. He has been fortunate, but the ways that he's been fortunate has also led to a lot of like trauma, right? So like his parents don't really support his belief systems and what he wants to do with his life because they expect him to become a well-to-do individual, right? So like there's like all of these ways that the different parts of his identity lead to conflict within himself and then also within the story. And that's what I mean by intersectionality. So like people aren't just monsters, they are also their backgrounds, they're also their relationships with their parents, they're also their jobs, they're also how they view themselves, how they align ideologically. All of those things are a part of their identity, and it causes conflict within individuals and within groups.
And he is not only one of your protagonists, but you have chosen him to be a leader of the Monster Solidarity movement. And it's interesting, these scenes in the novel where you were in a lot of meetings in this novel, by the way.
Right.
So whether it's Monster Solidarity or a cooperative, you're really into cooperatives. So talk a bit about writing scenes where we're actually in meetings and writing it in a manner that still captures and keeps the attention of the readers. Because I know it's hard to keep the attention of people actually in real meetings,
No,
much
for
less
sure.
writing about them.
Yeah, and I think, this was very deliberate on my part, kind of pairing this kind of like solidarity collective organizing stuff with Fantastic Elements, because I felt like this is the way that you can really show collectives in action in a way that will allow readers that aren't particularly into that stuff to kind of stick around and kind of see where it's going, because it's about, many of these meetings have monsters in them, or they're talking about monsters, and so they'll have like rules of like when who speaks and when, and they'll come to votes and all this stuff. But it's about a subject that I think is like inherently interesting to a lot of readers. It's about the speculative element that people might kind of grab onto. So it's allowing for something that I in our everyday life can be quite boring and uninteresting. I don't think so, but it is, right? And something that is unusual. And so that mix of unusual with very, very mundane, I think, allows for me to have a scene that is a meeting that then turns into an action scene, right? And so then, you readers will follow along and it kind of has this interesting effect, or at least that's what I was intending, of like kind of lulling you into comfort before things blow up. Because one of those aspects is something that feels very like mundane
All right, I'm going to
and
tell my
very.
listeners, I didn't ask him to give you that much detail.
Right. But I thought a
No,
lot about it.
there are some exciting things that happen. It's
Right.
not just a mundane meeting. And but, once again, when I read the scenes, it does make me think of, I've read a lot of about the history of the civil rights movement and some of the meetings and some of the things that have happened. So, did you steep yourself in this type of history in preparation to write this novel, the series?
So, I mean, yes and no. I mean, some of the meetings are inspired by, before I started writing about cooperatives and solidarity economics, I was already interested in it just, in the real world. And so I was a part of and I still am, I'm just not as active as I used to be, grassroots economic organizing collective. That's the name. And we would have retreats. We would have where we would talk about budget, budget for the next year for the collective, and we would talk about projects that we could, start, and ways that we could get more investment by the community, and also ways that we could recruit more collective members, all of that stuff. And so like I borrowed heavily from that experience, right? Like having a day long meeting at a retreat, broken up by meals, and having this kind of stack system of you raise your hand so that the facilitator can know that you're the next person in the stack to speak on an issue, blah blah blah, right? So I borrowed heavily from that, but I also, and I did this a lot more, and we had a crisis because I just didn't have as much mobility during the writing of this one. I read a lot of I read a Black Panther, has like a it's like Black Against Empire. It has like a really long title. So I read that. I read a couple more books that just kind of like gave me an idea of what these kind of social movements were like, and I borrowed from that, loosely. Use that as some inspiration as well.
Would I be wrong to say this is speculative fiction with the birth of a movement as a big thematic part of the novel, or birth of movements? You got the cooperative economics, which is really big, and the monster solidarity movement, which is really big.
Yeah, they're kind of like intersecting movements. And again, by design, I kind of was like, how would monsters support each other? And I was like, solidarity economics, pooling resources. It's basically the way that you would think about solidarity economics is people creating a worker co-op and co-owning and co-governing it, or people creating like a collective fund, where they can, that which allows them as a group to be able to afford things they couldn't afford as individuals, and that kind of thing. And I was like, this is a way that monsters would be able to support each other, so it makes sense. But there's also like, human supremacist movement, that is developing in the books as well. So yeah, it's like the story, and I framed this like I wrote a blog about how to read the series because it's such a complicated thing to read, and it was a complicated thing to write. And I framed it as this is a community is the protagonist, and this is how the community is built over time. So We Had a Crisis is the second part of the building of the community. And by the end of We Had a Crisis, it sets up what the community looks like for the third book.
There's a cliffhanger at the end, and it's not about the community.
Yeah, there's multiple
No,
cliffhangers.
I'm talking about the literally the literal end.
No, the
The literal
total
end.
cliffhanger. Yeah.
So you have a plethora of points of view. Alex, Alexandra, Ridley, Rebecca, Sandra, Dragon. But the thing that is interesting is you have a lot of characters that provide a point of view, but you are meticulous about building out those characters through the book. And sometimes in speculative fiction, they don't build out the characters. So talk about how you were able to build out these characters, meaning as you read about them, one scene, one chapter, next scene, that these characters are trained. They're evolving characters in the book, and you're giving them backstories. So talk a bit about the process of trying to fit all of that in.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is maybe inadvisable. Like, I
Wait,
get,
inadvisable?
well, I
Don't you
mean,
tell.
like, because, I get very invested in backstory for characters. And for me, it's like,
I
as
love
a reader,
backstory. I love
right?
backstory. So let me be clear. I love backstory.
As a reader, like, I really like getting to know the character to see how you know, their background informs their decisions, right? And their conflicts. And so a lot of what I'll do is I'll kind of like have like past action and then present action, and the past action informs the present, you know? And so I structure it that way for a lot of the characters. When you first meet a character, you get a lot of stuff about who they are and who they've been up until this point. And that stuff leads to where they end up. You know, I did it in the first book, and I did it when I introduced new characters and we had a crisis. And I just find that really, you know, fun and interesting. The other thing that I like to do is, and this, you know, going back to intersectionality, I just like to think a lot about all the different aspects of a person, and how that plays into how they would relate to things. You know, so Ridley again has all of these aspects to who he is. He also likes he has hobbies. He has, you know, he did wood carving as a kid, and then it kept up, you know. And so I just think a lot about what characters are interested in as well as who they are and how that informs the story. But sometimes, you know, like it means that I have to be like, I spend some time doing the traditional plot, and then some time doing this kind of like thematic world building for a character.
Let's talk about one of my favorite characters, Alex, Alexander Trapp, because first I got a trivia question. So her last name is Trapp. It's an adopted name because she's adopted by not Walter Trapp, but Walter Trapp. And Trapp is the name of the family that The Sound of Music was based on out of Austria. And for those who may not be familiar with that movie that came out in 1965, it was the highest grossing movie of all time by 1966. So I got to ask you, were you thinking of, did you just randomly come up with Trap and my brain just went back to 1965?
To be honest, yes.
That's not the answer I want.
Yeah, no. To be honest,
Oh, man.
I wish I could take credit for that level of thought. I mean, it kind of came out of, so the last name Trap kind of came out of like a in-story joke. So like in No Gods, No Monsters, you know, there's a character named Harry, and he goes to a secret society meeting that kind of takes a turn, you know, no spoilers. But the house is owned by
Mr. Trap.
Mr. Trap. And you know, the whole time the butler that, you know, brings him into the house is telling him about the house and the history of the house, all he's hearing is trap, trap, trap in his head, right? So it's like, this is a trap, basically. And I was like, this is a, you know, it's a cool, interesting last name. As the story developed, you know, Trap becomes more important to the series as a whole. Like I already had known that he was going to be, that the Trap compound would have been important, but I kind of discovered in the drafting of the second book how close the relationships were to other characters. And so with saying things without saying things, Trap becomes very important and will be very important moving forward.
So give us a quick tour of the character of Alex. Her father dies, or she's told he's sick, and then he's dead, and she gets adopted, and there's CIA and other stuff going on there. So I'll let you decide what you want to reveal about one of my favorite characters, Alex.
I'll give you background. I mean, some of this is stuff that you'll discover as you read, and it's well, okay. I'll say this. She comes from a like a intelligence dynasty. So her father was in the CIA, and so was her father's father. Like they are in intelligence, and she doesn't know that at the time when she's a kid. But a series of things happen that end up, you know, with her being orphaned, and then she's adopted by the mentor of her father, also her mentor, Walter Trapp. And Walter Trapp has he's incredibly wealthy, incredibly powerful, and has an interesting background. And so she kind of becomes this, like, you know, also she gets into the family business and becomes CIA as well. But then after she leaves the CIA, she has this whole second career as in covert spy work for an organization that is central to the story.
So once again, I'm gonna go back into the vault of something from a long time ago. A book called The Spook Who Sat By the Door. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard of it,
Novel.
yes.
Right. So it did give not the book itself, but that character that uses the experiences they learn from being in the CIA to do other things.
Right. And so yeah, that's the in the forward action of the story, the plot, you find Alex after she's left the CIA and she's infiltrated a group and she's doing, the same kind of skill. She's using the same kind of skill she used when she was in CIA, but this is different. She's in a different kind of world. It's a darker, stranger world that she's infiltrating.
So after these two obscure references, at least obscure for people who aren't from the baby boomer era, are you going to go back and watch The Sound of Music and read The Spook Who Sat By the
I mean, now I really want to, so I can make these
Door?
things. This happens to me a lot, where I'll make some connection to something. This is just how my brain works, and then I'll later on backfill like what it means. So there's like a, so the short answer is yes. But I was thinking about this moment in the first book where Harry, same character, sees like a bunch of people, wait staff that have like flesh cored out from their forearms, right? And I had no idea when I wrote that scene why they had those scars. And but in the second book, it just came to me. I was like, oh, it's this kind of like this monster that does a very specific thing. It's one of the only non-human monsters. And so it's, it was just, that was just random. And so like I like making connections back to things without knowing that that was a connection before. So if I go back and read this book, Who Sat By the Door, and I find some interesting connection there, I will likely fill that in to the third book, right? That's
Wow,
it's something
that'd
I
be
like to do.
cool. But there are some actual historical references you have in the book, some characters that literally do come out of the past. And I knew about Aleister Crowley, occultist. I was familiar with him, but I didn't know about Marjorie Cameron and Jack Parsons, who are in your book and related to one of the monster characters, Dragon. And Marjorie Cameron was a artist. She was married to Jack Parsons. They were sort of following this new religion that Aleister Crowley started up. So talk about your decision to bring this in as background for Dragon and bringing these characters. Literally, these days we just go look it up in Wikipedia and say, is that a real character? And say, oh yes, it is.
Yeah, I mean, ooh.
You don't want to reveal much, do you?
No, I can't. So like Marjorie Cameron shows up in the first book. She's referenced by a character named Six Alfred Nine. Also, as a connection to Harry. Harry's showing up a lot in our conversation. And Six Alfred Nine is obsessed with Marjorie Cameron as like an artist and this person that kind of intersected with a lot of different people in the art and occultist world during like the 40s, 50s, 60s. So she had like less than one degree of separation for Aleister Crowley. She also was her husband was great friends with L. Ron Hubbard, the father of Scientology. And so like there's all of this like she had like relationships with beat poets. And she was like this really strange avant-garde artist. She acted in movies. A lot of stuff that I know about her background just don't make it into the story because there isn't enough space. And also her background is even stranger than the story. She has this whole obsession with like creating a race of like mixed race children, right? Called Moon Children for some like occultist end. And I just avoided that because I was like, that's something that would need to be unpacked a ton. So I just kind of avoided it. But no, She was referenced in the first book, and I just knew that I had to return to her and build her out and have her be like this, like the historical figure of the second book, because the historical figure of the first one was Hugh Everett III, you know, the guy that came up with the many worlds principle. Her background, her relationship isn't actually, it's kind of tangentially to Dragon. It's the kid, the child in the second book is it's actually someone that Dragon interacts with in the first book very briefly.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to. There's
Can I say
another.
there's a goddess in this novel?
Yeah, there's and the child that comes out of that whole Margaery Cameron story is really important to the third book.
The
You just
third
don't,
book.
yeah, you
So,
just
how far
don't.
along are you on the third book? Are you there
I would
yet?
say I'm like a third of the way through. And I am, yeah, that character is already like showing up in the third book.
So you open and close with Calvin. So Calvin is raising his niece Gina, the daughter of his deceased brother. His mother's pain from the death of his brother is so great that she really doesn't want to interact with Gina. Calvin's moved back to the Virgin Islands. His mother lives, I believe, is it North Carolina? Is it North Carolina?
Yeah,
Right.
North
So,
Carolina.
talk about this sort of this kind of, well, not kind of contentious relationship caused by the pain, and then Calvin has his own special power. So, we talk about the multiverse. So, we got Earth 001, we got Earth 0529 or 0539.
I think it's 3-9, yeah.
0539. So let's you sort of unpack this Calvin, Gina the mother, and Calvin's interaction with the multiverse. If you can do that in less than 30 minutes.
Yeah, so Calvin, what's interesting is,
Is
there's,
Calvin you?
I would say
Sort
that
of, a little bit.
sort
Yeah, I
of, a
mean,
little bit,
yeah.
I would say, in terms of characterization or background, he has more similarities to my background than any other character. There's also a lot of differences for sure,
Oh, for sure, for sure. But he's a writer
like,
like you.
yeah,
And he
he's
writes
got.
about monsters like you.
Yeah, and he has this like, his younger brother passed away. It's not the same story for me. It's slightly different. But that kind of kicks off a lot of like stuff in his personal life that he's dealing with, just on a human level. And then, as this is about to happen, he starts to develop this ability. And this ability kind of leads to him, he starts to use it to kind of hide from his own trauma and pain. And, the series is about his explorations of that ability through following this totally unrelated story to himself, or at least he thinks it is, and then over the course of the trilogy, a little bit in the first book and, definitely in the second book, you find out that he's much more intricately connected to the events of the story than he thinks. And he's finding that out. And so, yeah, and his ability is basically this, when he sleeps, he can astral project into the fractal sea, which is basically just a metaphor for the multiverse. And he can go to different places in time and space that are outside of his universe. And it's a very private ability, like nobody else can follow him in there. But as he's in there, he's finding things and discovering things about how the universe works and the origins of like this very, very specific but very important conflict within the universe. And so yeah, that's his story. So he's dealing with like the loss of his brother and the fallout of that loss, because that has like estranged him from his brother's kid and the mother for reasons that aren't plot specific. And his mom has also been estranged from his niece, her granddaughter. And so, like, in the first book, it's him connecting with his niece. And then in the second book is his mother connecting with her granddaughter.
So, as a writer, why did you choose? This is for the aspiring writers listening. Why did you choose to open with him and close with him?
He's the framing narrative, right? So it's kind of like you set up an expectation in the reader's mind, even if they don't understand what's going on yet. So like the for No Gods, No Monsters opens with Cal meeting with a friend and talking about going back home. It's a very quiet opening, but it sets up a lot of groundwork for like how to read the story, even if you don't know yet. And then like you return to him over the course of the story. And so it's kind of this kind of it's part of the trick, right? So like I set up the eye, and then the eye goes away for a long time, and so it becomes about Lena and Rebecca and all these other characters. So it's in third person predominantly, but then occasionally you'll get the interjection of the eye again, and you it gives you the sense, or the intention was to give the reader the sense that the story is larger than even the stuff that's happening, the mainline storyline within the novel.
You have some secret societies that are featured in the novel. The Order of Asha, the Order of, what is that?
The Suvox.
The Suvox, and a splintering of the Suvox, I believe. And so, writing about these secret societies, what was the inspiration for these secret societies? Were they wholly cut from your imagination? Or did you read about other secret societies that sort of inspired you in the shaping of these?
Yeah, in the first book, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was mentioned. And that was a huge influence. And then I just started reading. I got interested in secret societies generally, just like as a concept. Like, why do they exist? And so like throughout the course of working on both books and this third one, I've just been reading and reading and reading about like conceptually what they are and why they come to exist, like what are the purposes of them, and how they interact with each other. And so a lot of it was just kind of like this scholarly interest, more than a scholarly interest. I find it fascinating, these kinds of like non-transparent organizations that act or try to act in the world, right? Lots of secret societies are built towards some objective, and then they try to enact that objective. And successful or not, it's interesting to me that people can organize privately to do that kind of stuff. And it makes for great thematic exploration of paranoia and how paranoia operates within the world as well. And that, so I'm just interested in it, like in this like philosophical way, but also in this kind of existential way. So it shows up a lot. The names of the secret societies are tied to gods. Part of the series is about monsters, and parts of the series is about gods. And so
Asha is a
those
god.
Asha is a god, and the Suvox is also a god. And so like really what's happening in the background of the story, and this isn't huge spoilers at this point, is that there's this kind of like proxy battle between gods that it's happening through the events and the people in the stories.
Sort of like Greek mythology.
Yeah, sort of like that, yeah.
So I got to ask you this question. I'm putting on my journalist hat, though I'm not a journalist. Are you a member of a secret society? And if you were a member, could you tell me you were a member of the secret society? And have you been hired by a secret society to write this book to reintroduce secret society secretly to society?
Okay. No.
I'm joking. I'm joking. I'm
The answer is no.
joking.
I'll tell you, there was like this kind of like I'm being recorded right now. There was an origin to my interest in secret societies that came out of like this paranoid thought I had. Like I was just like, oh.
People may start thinking you're a member of a secret society.
I mean, no, I mean, but like, it's not a secret that like Scientology came out of science fiction, right? Like there was, there's
Right,
like this
right.
really strong tie to science fiction. This big, very interesting, controversial like belief system, right? And it sort of, in some ways operates like a secret society. And so like I'm just like trying not to get in trouble with whoever is gonna listen to this. And so like I was just very interested in this idea of like people using things that, something like a genre fiction to kind of like plant a seed in people's minds and steer society in certain ways. And I was like, clearly you can do that. Is it happening more than we know? It was just like this very paranoid thought I had. And so, it kind of over time gestated and turned into something like this. It's not exactly like the secret societies in the novels aren't meant to be a one-to-one parallel with this idea, this paranoid idea, but they did. That paranoid idea did inspire aspects of how I decided to write the story, if that makes sense. So, short answer, no, but I have very interesting theories about this kind of stuff.
All right, I'm just gonna edit out everything else you say, except you have very interesting things about this stuff.
Theories, theories, just thoughts, just thoughts.
Well, I will say this. Reading this book and going back and looking through the previous one, what the word that keeps coming up in my mind to describe you is philosopher. Not in the rigid formal sense, but just deeply thinking about all these ideas and presenting just such a sort of being redundant here, but such a philosophical view on all these different issues. It sounds like you went down some rabbit holes and thought deeply about the rabbit holes you went down and found a way to sort of to bring that into the novel.
Yeah, I would say one of the big challenges and objectives of the novels is to try to bring to earth a thing I've thought very, very deeply about that I have not been able to translate any other way. And so like not about secret societies in particular, but like there's a lot more to the gods than I've been able to put on a page yet. The third book is like all philosophical things about gods, and they're created gods. They're not like they're not a part of any pantheon. So, but it is this kind of like vehicle for exploration about like what it means to create or be a creator and what would existence mean to creators, like what I'm very fascinated with, and this is one of the things that is mentioned when I'm, in the section with Hugh Everett. Infinite regression is kind of a throwaway line of like getting really deep into the weeds here. But like, how would a god know that they are the first thing in existence? How would they be able to prove that to themselves? And infinite regression is this theory that there's always a creator behind the created, even creators, right? So like you either a thing is eternal, always existed, or something made it. And if something made it, then something made that. And if something made that, then something made that,
Could be a
And
circle of infinity.
right, it's a circle of infinity. And so I've thought a lot about that. Too much probably. And so like it's very integral to the story and the conflict of the story. It's just a thing that hasn't been able to make it down to earth yet. But like the whole third book is like me trying to bring that down to earth, like in a tangible, real way, in a way that feels like not just like a thought experiment, but like a something that's real that you can hold on to.
As you're going out to various audiences talking about the book, What are some of the most fascinating questions that are were so interesting that were asked you by an audience that you still remember that question?
I mean, some of it has to do with this stuff, right? Readers are incredibly smart, and they pick up on things, even things that you are just lightly touching on. Sometimes they pick up on things that I have no intention of, and and then I'm like, that's a very interesting
You mean
thing.
like the sound of music?
I'm like, oh, that's very interesting. And then I start saying, and then I have no qualms about like incorporating things that are brought to me. I take them as gifts. But people ask me if there's a connection between the Convergent Saga, these two books, and my debut book. And I am always very happy when someone asks me that question, because then I could be like, yes, and not say more, but just say like, yes, this kind of like, this is one of my favorite writers. I think it's fair to say this now. I've read enough of her work. Is Emily St. John Mandel, and she wrote. The first thing I read was Station 11, and then I, branched out and read more of her novels. But she has this project in her novels of this kind of like literary multiverse where she has all of her stories are in conversation with each other, like intimately. They're not just like. She's kind of like building this Uber novel, basically, of all of these cast of characters and how they intersect or don't intersect in different timelines. Right? I find that very interesting. And this is a huge project for my work. Like it's very intentional that there's relationships between my short fiction and my long fiction. There's relationships between all my books. They're subtle. This Convergent Saga is a way to kind of like turn up the volume on it for a minute and then turn it down again. I'm building towards making those connections stronger as well. So yeah, I really like when people ask me that, because then I can kind of just smile, and be like, yeah, there's something there.
So how do you keep all these characters, now we'll include the lesson three novels, how do you keep all these characters from conflicting with previous incarnation of them in the different short stories, the different books? Do you have, will someone go in your house and there's this huge board with all these characters' names and all these lines and stuff drawn across?
No, I wish. I wish I was that organized, because then I think it would help me a lot. To be truthful, so far I've managed to avoid contradictions by extreme luck. I haven't found, like over the course of revising novels, you change background stuff about characters and all kinds of stuff. And so far nothing has been so terribly wrong that it doesn't create an opportunity. So like there's like a phrase in the lesson. It's one of the only artifacts that really connects them right now. Called it's something like the oh man. There is no armor strong enough to save you nowhere ever. That shows up in the lesson. And it shows up differently in No Gods, No Monsters. There's no armor big
Did
enough.
Gina say that?
Yeah, no, Gina says it because Gina notices it in the in We Are the Crisis. She's like,
Okay.
wait a second, these two quotes are the same. But they're slightly different. Like the term that it's strong and big is used in respective instances. And that was not initially intentional. That was just me making an error. But then I thought about it and I was like, there's a good reason for this error. And so it spiraled out and created an opportunity. And that's what happens a lot. Like I'll either make a mistake or I'll put something in there that is like something that just feels right at the time. And then I'll start asking questions about it. I'll just prod it and then I'll come up with a plausible explanation for it. That's the process I am sure eventually it's going to lead to like big glaring mistakes. And so one of the things that I have been trying to do this time around is kind of put it all in one place. I'm still in the process of doing that so that I can, it's not just in my head, because I think it's starting to get too big for my head.
Or your head big enough.
Yeah, I think my head might explode if I keep trying to just keep it in there and not put it in some other place that I can look at.
I'm looking forward to the next book. Is the title? You can't share the title, can you?
I
There's no
mean,
title yet, is there?
there is a title, and I don't think it's going to change. I think the publisher likes it. So it's a ruin, great and free. And so it's based on like a Franco-Spain what is it? What's the word that I'm looking for?
Franco
Like a
Spain,
slow.
as in the dictator.
Yeah, it's a slogan. So like all of these are like political slogans. So No Gods, No Monsters is a riff off of No Gods, No Masters. We are the crisis. It's an anarchist slogan. And A Ruin, Great and Free is based off of One Great and Free, which was like a slogan of like fascist Spain, basically.
So should I be referring to you as a political philosopher? Because we didn't even talk about the argument for statehood or to not have statehood for the U.S. Virgin Islands,
Yeah, and
which
I kind
Sandra
of
has, and her husband, the senator, she's a former senator. There's a lot of discussion about that.
yeah, and I kind of keep kicking that can down the road because I don't have a good answer to it. I just like thinking and talking about it. And so I have like those two characters are on different sides of that debate. And so they're having that debate because I'm having that debate in my head. I see pros and cons for any route. So independence has pros and cons, you know. I know a lot of people that are pro independence for the US Virgin Islands. You know where I'm from. The another option is statehood, and I know a lot of people that are pro statehood. Another option is like kind of like a sovereign country within another country, which is like the United Kingdom approach, right? Like they're it's a nation within a nation,
A
basically.
Commonwealth type of deal.
Right. And I think there's good arguments, pros and cons for that argument. And then a lot of people are just like, let it stay exactly the way it is. Like being a territory is a good, slippery, middle ground gray zone that allows for some autonomy and then some kind of, protectorship, from by the United States. And there's pros and cons to that. And I don't know who I'll piss off by saying this, but I have not made up my mind on that. Like the thinking that I think comes closest to it. From my perspective is Sandra's kind of like bottom up road to something. Like it has to be you build in the community a shared sense of direction that is a collectivist view that then builds into reality. You don't like impose a view from above or from outside. So like yeah, my answer is like whatever would make sense to like a very invested Virgin Islands, I don't think we are right now very invested in the question. There's pockets of investment, but not like a collective investment. And so like whatever we would determine, it would have to be through a collective kind of decision-making process that you have to build a culture for that. And that's something I'm interested in. I don't know where it's gonna go. I'm still kind of like deciding whether or not I'm gonna answer that question in the third book, or kind of like just get closer to an answer in the third book. It's a big question for me. More than you
Well,
probably asked.
no. This has been a great discussion. I really enjoy having these discussions with you, Cadwell Turnbull, author of the novel We Are the Crisis. You won any more awards again? I named, being starred review, but I think you got some more recognition on top 10 science fiction fantasy lists.
The book, I'm being real when I say this, to my absolute surprise, has made a lot of like end of the year best of lists, and so that has been a huge relief, because this book was way harder to write than No Gods, No Monsters, because I was doing it as I was teaching and as I was starting this kind of other like big project, big author project with a bunch of other folks. And so it was just a hard juggle to work on this, and it was just really hard to write and revise. It was an extremely painful creation process, and so it's been a huge relief that people feel like it's a good follow-up to the first book. And so my goal right now is to make the third book as close to my own dreams for it as possible, now that I have a little bit more space to kind of like work on it. Also, not answer your question. It made like best of the year for like Kirkus and Library Journal and a couple other things,
Wow.
which has been a huge blessing.
That's amazing. CadwellTurnbull.com, is that right? Your website address? We Are the Crisis. I really love the book. I'm looking forward to the next book. And thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.